This is Hans Reimer, Montgomery County Council Member, and you're listening to the Conduit Street Podcast, the official podcast of the Maryland Association of Counties.
And welcome to the Conduit Street Podcast. Kevin Canale here with my co-host, Michael Sanderson. And we are obviously still social distancing. We're still dealing with the coronavirus. But Michael, I'm very excited today for this bonus episode of the podcast. What do we have in store today?
Good to be on the line with you, Kevin, and also really excited to have our guest this morning. We've been talking about issues that we wanted to cover as part of the podcast. And we reached out to a figure who we're lucky is a resource in the state of Maryland, but also is a big player on public policy and liberty issues, working with the Cato Institute. Walter Olson, a resident of Frederick County, is involved in a variety of civic things in Maryland policy, came down and joined us at the MACO Summer Conference, and we were able to make some connections down there. And we've had him on our to-be-invited list for the podcast for some time. We're lucky to have made things work for this recording this week. Walter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael and Kevin both.
As we sit here on Monday at about 11:30, the governor just held a press conference, Governor Hogan. Sounds like tonight there will be a stay-home order as of 8 p.m. And I think, as you mentioned, this ties right into Walter's work. What kind of issues typically are you interested in outside of what's happening right now with the Cato Institute? What are you normally tracking and concerned with?
I write about legal issues. That includes a lot of constitutional issues because I'm with the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. So first thing I look at is often the constitutional background. Very interesting in the case of government emergency powers in a pandemic. And then I write about a lot of miscellaneous issues, usually with law or regulation slant, often business and economic regulation. You know, but ranging family law, discrimination law, lots of different areas, usually with the law side.
And your main involvement, you know, tying into Maryland, you're a Maryland resident. Your main involvement recently in county government, at least, has come over the past 9 or so months as a member of the Frederick County Charter Review Commission. Is that right?
That is right. It was a very fun project, collegial. We came through with some small but useful recommendations, and by stroke of luck, we wrapped up our work just a few days before the closed down orders began.
So pretty good timing there, I guess.
Excellent timing.
And you were also involved in redistricting in Maryland, correct?
I have been on both of Governor Hogan's commissions as co-chair. First, the Maryland Redistricting Reform Commission, which drew up a general blueprint for how we might stop gerrymandering and move to a citizen commission-driven system, and then more recently, the Emergency Commission on 6th District Redistricting. And there, too, because those ideas require the Maryland legislature to act, I have to say the chances were not all that great, even before the session terminated early. But of course, they, along with so much else, lost whatever remaining hope of passage during those last hurried weeks.
I think Walter, you know, Kevin and I had been thinking that talking about reapportionment of districts in the wake of the upcoming census and so forth would probably make a really ripe topic to bring you on as a guest. And I think that's still the case. But the issue of the moment, your prominence on issues of civil liberties is what's got us interested at the moment, as we in Maryland and across the country and much of the world are amidst a public health scare. It's really unlike anything most of us have ever experienced. It's raising some public policy issues that seem, in my judgment, to be very much in your wheelhouse. And to our listeners, Walter is a great follow on social media. The research and articles and just offhand observations that he lets go off on legal and policy issues are really interesting. I think you've got two profiles on Twitter, one for your national reputation and one for your more Maryland and locally focused issues. I follow both and find both of them a constant stream of things that are worth tucking aside, put in the reading file for some time when I've got 10 minutes. So please take that as a compliment. And we're really thrilled to have you here to talk about the issues of the moment, which sort of start with the coronavirus and our collective response to it, and you know, governments at every level taking this seriously, but it raises practical issues on the relationship between the government and private citizens and private businesses.
Well, let me jump in then on that, because the restrictions on individual liberty that happen in an epidemic emergency are amazing. No one now alive really remembers anything as severe. The Spanish flu episode around the end of World War I was comparable, and yet no one remembers that. So we are, for nearly all of us, entering something new. Some people may have memories of the 1950s when there were public health orders closing beaches and pools and things, but for most of us, we're encountering these things for the first time. And I come at it from a libertarian point of view, but also from a constitutionalist point of view. And there is some surprises in store for those who think that libertarians, like myself, or classical liberals, will automatically take the side of, no, this is all improper, the government should not be ordering us around. I turn to the Constitution, and I've got a piece coming out tomorrow which points out that one founder who knew all about quarantine was Alexander Hamilton. Mm-hmm. With his wife, Eliza, survived yellow fever in Philadelphia, fled to Albany, where her family was from, of course, and were promptly sealed up in the Schuyler Mansion in Albany and not allowed to come out for quite some time because the Albany authorities thought they would be infectious. Now, Hamilton griped about the details, but he did not, I think, gripe about the general principle, nor would any of the other framers gripe about the general principle that in an epidemic emergency, the government gets a bunch of powers that we could never let it have at other times.
Right. And Walter, I guess, you know, we've seen states, including Maryland, states across the country, though, exercising police powers, right, during this public health emergency. And I think there are some people who would say, wait a minute, this is a violation of my constitutional rights. And as you mentioned, typically, we would never allow the government to get away with shelter-in-place orders, forcing businesses to shutter, et cetera, et cetera. So talk a little bit about the rationale and where that authority comes from. I think it's important to sort of set the stage in terms of the Constitution and what it allows in a crisis like this.
Exactly. And we'll get back to those issues of what we shouldn't let it allow in non-emergency times. But you mentioned the police power, and that's a good concept to start with. Under the scheme of the Constitution, the police power is this big residual power to not just respond to crime, as the name might imply, but also to do things like restrict movements during an epidemic. And one notable thing is that police power starts out with the states and their subdivisions like cities. Mm-hmm. It's not a general federal power. And so you trace this forward today. Things haven't changed since the framing of the Constitution. States were then and states continue now to be the ones with the police power to respond to epidemics. One of the implications that often surprises people is that although President Trump may talk about wanting to end the lockdowns, it's not his power. He can't order the states around. It's up to the states. So first, states have the police power. And secondly, it's surprisingly big. It often surprises people, if you go back and look at the judicial precedent of what states have been allowed to do, just how sweeping the deference in emergencies is. And this is not just pandemics, it's also true of riots or other emergencies. But to go back to the Spanish flu, for example, someone tried to find litigation in which courts ordered states to stop anything they were doing in the Spanish flu episode. Of course, they did very drastic things as far as quarantines and the like. And right. No court ever told them to stop. That's how big the difference is.
Wow.
So even on issues such as freedom to assemble, freedom to worship, I mean, those are obviously central to the First Amendment. And exactly. You're saying that the police powers override the First Amendment in this case when it comes to freedom to assemble, freedom to worship, etc.
Yeah, nothing could be more central in the Bill of Rights than things like freedom to worship, freedom to assemble. And you can go on, freedom to travel is not mentioned in so many words, but it has been read into the Constitution in certain ways. And the right to a day in court. You notice that in Maryland and increasingly everywhere, the court's work simply stops or restricts itself to passing on the most emergency things by the distance, Zoom or Skype. And ordinarily, you would have a right to get court relief on things both related to the emergency and unrelated to the emergency. That's also suspended for the moment.
It's interesting to me that I think a lot of Americans are maybe absorbing a refresher of their old 10th grade civics class in the last week or so when you mention an announcement from the president has a different weight than the powers of the states when really, you know, it's not up to the president how to exercise this authority, whether this is a function of the 10th Amendment or if it's just an implied power that's reserved for the state. This really isn't a federal government responsibility. So, you know, the idea of we'll revive the economy by Easter or after 30 days or whatever, you know, I think a lot of us are finding out that our real guidance is coming at the state level. And implicitly, we're learning that the federal authority is basically defined by what was ceded to it by the states in the Constitution. So a helpful reminder, maybe.
We're reminded of that. And also a lot of people are being reminded that the states are highly functional in a way that I can't always say is true of Washington, D.C. and you can contrast here. Obviously, some federal agencies have a big role to play either in helping state epidemic response or at various points along the way, like the Food and Drug Administration with its power to approve or disapprove medical tests and medical designs of medical devices and so forth. And those agencies have been caught flat-footed. It's not their finest hour. They were not well prepared and they did not make good decisions. Where you do find real national leadership that has led the conversation is in many states around the country. And that's as it should be, but it's also a reminder that a kind of narrative that you heard for many, many years about states being somehow wave of the past and, big modern countries have central government to lead everything. I don't think it was ever quite true, but it's certainly getting reexamined now.
I think it's very interesting, Walter, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this. I have seen that public polling continues to show that the U.S. public generally approves of these coercive measures that are, you know, being used to combat this epidemic. And in many cases, there's little gap in between parties when it comes to that approval. What do you make of that? How do you come up with the rationale for so many people understanding here and sort of giving in to these measures that are being implemented in states?
I saw those polls too, and I was also fascinated both by the generally narrow partisan gaps.
Right.
You know, it doesn't take much to generate a huge gap between one party and the other.
Sure.
But on these questions of should the government act in certain ways to respond to this emergency, much smaller gaps and sometimes no gaps at all. And also very drastic kinds of powers being approved that in ordinary times would be, to say the least, controversial. So the public, I think, and this has been observed in times of serious wartime, like World War II, public psychology changes. Someone has said about the American national character, Churchill said it in one way, but it's been said by others, America's slow to react and then mighty when it does. You know, America was not the first to, and not even early to respond to the challenge of this epidemic. But once America gets going, boy, is it ever a mighty country. And so I think you're going to see in coming weeks, and it doesn't mean that there won't be false starts and bad policies. And we've already seen some policies that I think went too far and have appropriately been scaled back a little bit in places like Pennsylvania. But you will see, I think, as it emerges in other emergencies like wartime, you will see a lot of willingness to support policies that do promise to work.
So I guess as a, from a libertarian point of view, to some degree concerning that in a time of crisis, people who might otherwise share your concern about the potential conflict between government overreach and individual liberties, suddenly it's wartime or suddenly we're in something of a panic like at the moment, and people's perspective change an awful lot. We saw that, you know, in the wake of 9/11, certainly in true wartime, we've seen that. That's lingering in the background as public opinion can move quickly on these sorts of things.
Let me say several things about that. Let's start from a libertarian standpoint. Libertarians believe that we need to have our rights protected against physical aggression. Now, something strange that happens in an epidemic, and not typically at other times, is that ordinary well-meaning people turn into missiles of destruction. If they run into us and spend 10 minutes with us chatting on the street, whether we know it or not, they may be the instrument of the death of someone in our family.
Right.
Not what happens in ordinary times. And so, to me, the libertarian analysis of epidemic powers begins with the idea that governments are instituted to protect us against whether deliberate or undeliberate threats to inflict bodily injury on us. And so I'm not as uncomfortable as some libertarians are with the idea that at least on a day-to-day threat basis, you can back up and talk about, well, what about smoking or some, what about a public health threat that manifests itself over 15 years or something? And I would come out at a different place on those. But when it's a matter of today's encounter could kill me or could kill my mother-in-law, the calculus does shift. And of course, in constitutional law, the calculus shifts in exactly the same way. We will get to the idea of how the government has to surrender its emergency powers once the emergency is over, because libertarians who have their eyes on the prize of civil liberty make that point early and strongly, which is anything you're letting the government do now, don't let that turn into a precedent for power that it can hold on to when normal times return. That would be disastrous. So that's part of it. Another part of it is that the Constitution can't be suspended, even if there is bending in areas like freedom of assembly. The government can't be allowed to declare itself above the Constitution. The courts still have to, in principle, be able to review and reverse in areas where they don't believe it's within the police power or don't believe it's within emergency authority granted, things like that. And we can get to the Steele seizure case, which is kind of the legal landmark on this, if we want. But just, you know, leaving it there, there has to be some rule of law that persists.
And, you know, so we will get to, you know, ultimately how this ends and how the constitutional rights are restored, so to speak. But I read an interesting piece that you wrote for Cato, and it's about takings. And I want to get your thoughts. You know, we've seen governments across the country closing all sorts of businesses, and they've ordered these businesses essentially into idleness, and workers and suppliers and contractors, their livelihoods depend on these businesses. They're now shut down. I think you wrote a piece about whether or not these should be considered takings of property for public use. So I think that's a fascinating question. In your mind, is this a situation where forcing these businesses to close should be considered takings?
It's a fascinating question, and it's got a legal side in the sense of what would the courts do, and it's got a kind of rough justice side in the sense of how do we want to treat this given that it's a new situation for everyone. And it's different from ordinary times. On these economic issues of should there be a universal basic income, should there be subsidies to business, should there be rescue packages for one or another sector, you know where libertarians come out. 2 months ago, I would have said, you're crazy, get
right.
out of here.
Right.
You know, I would have been wagging my finger and lecturing as hard as anyone that in ordinary non-emergency times, each of those policies has serious downsides. Each of them, including business subsidies, tends to take you down a road in which government begins doing more and more damage. All of the influences that make government work less well. And without retreating one inch from all of those positions, I can still say that when the government has, you could call it created the crisis. We know the government didn't really create the crisis. In ordering things to close down, the government recognized the crisis that was already going on, but it also legally tied the hands of millions and millions of workers and countless small businesses who could not have predicted the situation, had done the best they can. I mean, you can argue about whether the airlines should have insured against this event, and maybe you've got a point about certain industries that should have had more rainy day funds or whatever. But for most of them, for the bars and restaurants, for the venues of so many sorts, no, it's not really reasonable to expect that they set up their entire business plan with the expectation of doing a 2.5 month holiday and kept a rainy day fund for that. So if the government's ordering this, you can't make people completely whole because there isn't enough money to make everyone completely restored for the incredible for what's happened to them.
Would the Supreme Court here rule that these sort of takings require just compensation under the Fifth Amendment's taking clause?
Once you frame it as that legal issue, the answer is probably no. Mm-hmm. And the analysis by this, by my friend Ilya Soman, who is an eminent domain specialist at Scalia Law at George Mason, he says, if you go back to the cases, you will find that typically the courts will order compensation only when there was a physical occupation. So if, for example, the city of Baltimore takes some large vacant open space for a field hospital against the wishes of its owners, then because it's occupied that space, it probably does owe them eminent domain compensation.
Right.
Short of that, they close you down, but they haven't sent a state employee onto your property. There hasn't been an occupation. You probably can't get compensation from the courts. As I say, there's this divergence between what the courts will order and what the rest of us might think is nonetheless rough justice for you to get some compensation for.
Right. And so those would be these emergency rescue payments, understanding that shutting these businesses down, obviously, they could not have prepared for this type of situation. They couldn't have had, as you said, the rainy day funds on hand to deal with a shutdown for months and months at a time, especially in an industry like restaurants and bars where the margins are super thin.
And the employees, too. You know, don't forget that they're in the same situation. Where they got their livelihood has been forcibly shut by the government, and not unreasonable for them to think, this is not your ordinary situation. Unemployment compensation will help, but it's probably not the whole answer.
So as this sort of reckoning goes step by step, it seems like we know we have a public health crisis and policymakers have to deal with the big obvious issues. Do you close schools? Do you ask restaurants and bars to limit or abridge service? You kind of work your way from the obvious to the less obvious. One of the things that you've written about recently that I think not everybody has considered is the way our economy has been changing, and more people are making their income through a relationship that doesn't necessarily resemble or fit into the box of the old school employer-employee relationship. All the people who are part of the gig economy and freelance working as drivers or producers of content or whatnot, that seems like a weak link in a lot of both the what does the government do in telling things to shut down, but also in the remedies that we're seeing from the government in trying to leave people at least close to whole. You have any broader thoughts about how this gets untangled and how much trickier things are than they might have been 20, 30 years ago?
Well, this trend toward contractor employment, toward having more than one employer, toward the so-called gig economy, has been in progress for a while, and it generated this enormous political and policy backlash in which, and this has been state by state, California, New Jersey, New York have seen massive efforts led by labor unions to force work into a traditionally one employer time clock mold. And California went furthest with its AB5, a law that went after sectors like independent trucking, delivery work, and musical and artistic gig workers, and attempted to say if you repeatedly employ workers in these categories, then you have to turn into their paternalistic employer and begin doing all of these things just as if you were GM in the 1940s. Now, I think it was the worst conceivable time to have a pandemic come along, which put tremendous stress and demand on the independent trucking sector, on the delivery sector, and in a different way, on the music gig sector by wiping it out completely so they wouldn't be getting the gigs in either case. But it has been a reason, and I'm not saying this should be a front burner issue, although I sure wish California would reconsider waging legal war on the delivery sector. It postponed the law by a year or two at least. But in the meantime, the rest of us need to think, because it's very, very hard to stamp out this new kind of work model without also stamping out a lot of the things that make the new economy more productive and more flexible. And now we find, as we are all shut in, enable it to serve needs that we had no idea would be so big.
Right.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It really is. And as you said, the timing is certainly fascinating as well. So Walter, you've teased it a few times, but what does ultimately happen once this public health emergency is over in terms of how these emergency measures that have been put into place are reversed? I mean, who is responsible for ensuring that that happens? And I'm sure folks like you and the Cato Institute are going to be on top of that. But talk a little bit about the process and why it's so important in your mind that they get this right and it's done in a timely fashion.
Well, the process, of course, starts out with the governors and the others who wield the police powers. And I would think a normal course to look for would be gradual withdrawal of lockdown and shelter-in-place orders in which different categories of relatively low risk and important commerce and movement can resume. They loosen up sector by sector or in some other way, perhaps with rules saying that you can go back on the streets, but not in groups bigger than such and such, or whatever, but a general loosening by the same people who did the tightening. That having been said, you look forward a little bit to where will things wind up when, let's say that we've beaten back the wave of the epidemic, and as in a number of Asian countries, and there's been a lot of literature about how generally friendly and recognizable countries like South Korea and Taiwan, which are not all that different from America in some way, have had lots of success at getting out of this epidemic. They pulled themselves out without having to turn into communist China and have massive repression. So we look at that, we find some grounds for optimism because they have been able in Singapore and various other places to get a lot closer to ordinary life back, not fully, but they got a lot of ordinary life back in those countries. Should I stop there before I move on to less optimistic?
Well, on that point, I did, I know I've been following, as Michael said, your Twitter handles are a fantastic follow. You mentioned South Korea, and I've seen a big thread in terms of masks and the success that they've had beating this epidemic back. And I remember at the beginning of this, the CDC public health officials were coming out and telling people, do not run out and buy masks. We need them in our hospitals. They won't be effective. But it seems to me like the CDC has done a complete 180 here. Do you want to comment on that a little bit?
Yes, the CDC has not yet done a 180, but I think it almost has to because there is way too much expertise now, not only from anyone you consult in South Korea or Taiwan or Singapore, who will all tell you Americans need to start wearing masks in public situations. We all do, they will say, and the evidence is now quite strong that it protects persons other than the wearer. The evidence is less strong, but I think still compelling that it provides some protection to the wearer. So do it. And yes, there is this hanging issue of, especially with these high-level quality ones that are used by medical professionals in the more dangerous situations. Yes, of course, but if you've got an open pack of it, you take that right to a medical professional and donate it.
Right, but such as the N95 masks, things like N95s. That.
But on the other hand, what we need for the time being is adequately served by sewing skills and leftover fabric. Seriously, that's enough to get us started for a few weeks. And after a few weeks, masks, especially of the conventional kind, but not the super strong kind, those sorts of masks will be coming back onto the market in quantities enough for our hospitals in some number of weeks. I don't know what that number is. In the meantime, you know, my philosophy on this is the cuter and the more obviously homemade it is, the better, because that sends the signal I didn't take one away from someone in the emergency room.
Very interesting. So let's get back to your pessimistic outlook then.
For a long time, Cato and I have written about emergency powers. And as soon as you hear a libertarian pronounce the phrase emergency powers, it's usually with a drooping look of, oh my God, emergency powers. We all know that emergency powers, the federal government assumed in World War II and the Korean War, remained in effect decades later. We know that the emergency rent control that New York New York City put in, was still, we've still got it today, and it was emergency World War II rent control. So the government often does not relinquish these powers, especially when there is some powerful interest group that wants to keep the thing in place. I noted that a medical group in New York that likes to sound off on gun issues said that Cuomo ought to declare a ban on guns as part of his general emergency management. Well, anytime you've got a crisis, you've got people looking to piggyback and looking to get their various agendas in with the idea of taking ground that they could not have taken in an ordinary in policy environment. So you got to watch out both for the things slipping in that don't actually respond to the emergency and for the unwinding process in which either they are sunsetted, that's one good start, a proclamation has an expiration date and the governor has to take responsibility for renewing it if it's still needed in another 60 days. Lots of these things are ways of ensuring that the classic syndrome, which libertarians were among the biggest ones to document and point out, of government acting under emergency powers long after the emergency, to make sure that isn't a permanent disease.
So I think that raises a little one-liner that I've seen, I don't know, I've lost count of how many times I've seen it over the last few weeks, but people making reference to libertarians and saying there are no libertarians in foxholes. You've been giving us some perspective on, you as someone with that bent who, at least in my judgment, has a very realistic point of view about all these things. Would you care to reframe or reconstruct that little one-liner in a way that you think is fairer to your brethren of the pro-liberty stripe?
I sure would, because my hackles did do a little upward jump when I saw that line, a glib line, in my opinion. And someone turned it around and said there are only libertarians in a pandemic. And if that seems surprising, consider all the regulations we have thrown on the bonfire in the last 3 weeks. And I loved Governor Hogan's announcements here in Maryland when he said, this was early and it was totally sensible. He said, everyone who's got an expiring license for anything, a business license, a driver's license or whatever, everyone is home free until 30 days after the official emergency ends. Right. Don't go in and crowd the DMV trying to renew your license at this point. Wonderful idea. And likewise, when Governor Baker in Massachusetts said, the need for medical professionals to be able to get to where the patients are is great enough that we are going to suspend non-recognition of valid, non-suspended out-of-state medical licenses. Again, libertarians were saying not only is this good and needed now, but hey, let's think about whether maybe we didn't need those barriers in to begin with. What we have been arguing, and one of the many hats I wear in Maryland is that I'm a member of the task force on reforming occupational licensure that Governor Hogan's cabinet secretaries have pulled together, particularly. We had been considering those issues, finding that things like the extreme reluctance to recognize out-of-state medical licenses, even when they were, and cosmetology licenses and so forth, even when there's no evidence that cosmetologists coming in from Texas are bad cosmetologists. It hurt military families. It hurt all sorts of people who didn't realize they would be moving and don't want to have to go through the whole process again now that they're in our state.
Yeah, it definitely feels to me like we will have a wave of policy re-reckoning in the wake of this crisis. And it may be that things like occupational licensing and blue laws and restrictions on particular, I mean, like all the bending over we're doing for the alcoholic beverage industry.
Which is a complete 180 here in Maryland.
I have to say, so many of my friends have said, we're not giving up alcohol home delivery. When all this
I do feel like probably in some subtle ways, but in some obvious ways, we're going to collectively go through that. And hopefully this is a matter of, weeks or months and not years, but then we get back to whatever normal looks like afterward. And there's some things that are going to feel different. And maybe having a sack of margaritas delivered to your front door is one of the things that society decides we have to have. I don't know.
Or to use a more serious example, telemedicine. We've observed, through terrible war, battlefield medicine has often been responsible for huge advances in conventional medicine. And we are now finding by this trial by fire that we've got to figure out telemedicine. We've got to make it work. And I don't think we're going to go back to the old system because it's just more efficient. When it was just going to be a talk session with the medical professional anyway, just more efficient to do a lot of it over Skype or Zoom.
And Walter, before we let you go, one more issue I'd like to just bring up with you and get your thoughts on the upcoming elections. Obviously, we have an upcoming special congressional election here in Maryland, and then we've postponed our presidential primary until early June. There's a lot of talk about the State Board of Elections moving to an all vote by mail system. Obviously, this is a discussion that's come up before. We've seen several pieces of legislation to do this in Maryland. We already have no excuse absentee voting. But in your mind, when it comes to an epidemic like this, particularly when we have so many of our poll workers are older people who are more susceptible, as we know, to COVID-19, where do you come down in terms of, look, we need to have polling places open, people need to exercise their right to vote, but at the same time, they're trying to make sure that they're not sick, that they don't get infected with COVID-19. When it comes to, balancing those two issues, are you concerned about moving to all vote by mail? Are you concerned that the timing is not sufficient to put a system in place that will really work? Or what are your thoughts on this issue as we move forward? And several states are grappling with this at this time.
Okay. Well, first, let me make clear that I speak only for myself on this.
Sure.
Even though
sure.
I work on some electoral issues with people in the government, I'm speaking only for myself. I think, yes, the case for vote by mail is overwhelming. And it's not as if it has to be invented from scratch. It's Washington State, isn't it, that already does it that way. We have already examples of it working well. Whether you include an electronic component, I don't know. But vote by mail is going to be safer for the duration of this emergency. We need to move as fast as we can to make it work and work well for November and to the extent we can for any primaries that come in between.
Very interesting. And Walter, remind our listeners how they can follow you. Of course, at the Cato Institute, you also have another website, which is fantastic and always is flowing with great content.
My regular daily writing is at overlawyered.com. That's I know.
That's great.
Is America overlawyered? Well, I took out a domain name to find out. It is, by most accounts, the world's oldest law blog. It started in 1999, which is really a long time ago.
Goodness.
It's got some lighthearted stuff. It's got some more serious stuff. And these days, it's got some pandemic stuff. But I also write, and my writing is gathered at the cato.org site. You've got to click through to its scholars, and then you'll find me. But on Twitter, I am at Walter Olson. That's O-L-S-O-N. And also at, you guessed it, Walter Olson, MD, for just the Maryland stuff, if you just want that. But also at the third account, Overlawyered, where you will find stuff a little more related to people suing the daylights out of each other and the other things I criticize over there.
And of course, they can follow Cato Institute at Cato Institute on Twitter.
Exactly. And you'll find so much good stuff if you do.
Michael, any closing thoughts before we let Walter go?
Just thrilled that you were able to make some time for us, and flattered to be on your rotation. I love reading your stuff. Enjoyed talking with you today, and hope we can do it again another time.
You are way too kind, and I appreciate the work of the Association of Counties. I loved going to the summer convention. Please, everyone, when they have conventions again, go to them. And appreciate all the work you do, including the podcast.
Very kind. Thank you so much. That'll do it for this special episode of the Conduit Street Podcast. We will be back later this week in our normal rotation with a new episode. If you enjoy the podcast, please give us a follow, subscribe. You can also follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and of course, the Conduit Street blog. Until later this week, Kevin signing off for Michael and Walter, and we will talk to you soon.